Strange Arrivals is a production of iHeartRadio and Grim and Mild from Aaron Mankey.
At dusk, in early August 2014, I saw lights in the sky. My wife and I were having dinner with another couple. We were at my family's summer cottage on an island in Lake Winnipesaukee. My wife saw them first, four or five red lights hovering above the horizon. It's impossible to say how far away they were. It was dark, and it's hard to estimate distances over water anyway. But they were at least a few miles off, probably more. We walked down from the porch and onto the dock. The lights moved slowly. They would be in one shape and then shift to another. At some point, two or three other lights materialized. We watched for several minutes. 4 years later, we all have different memories about how it ended. I still don't know what we saw that night in the New Hampshire sky. One person agreed with me that it was probably something ordinary. We just couldn't figure out what. But the other two shared a different opinion. They thought it was probably a UFO, something from outer space. We also can't agree on how the night ended. Those of us looking for an earthly explanation remember the lights blinking out one by one, as though they'd lost power. Those who thought the lights were extraterrestrial remember them flying off at great speeds. Nobody is budging on their memory. This incident was the kernel that began this podcast. If we all witnessed the same event, why would two of us think aliens and two think anything but aliens? More crucially, how did this initial assumption change the way we remembered what we saw? To try to get an answer to these questions, I decided to take a look at another sighting. One that took place almost 60 years ago at a spot about an hour's drive from where we stood that night. I'm Toby Ball, and this is Strange Arrivals. Episode 1, Falling Star. In September 1961, John F. Kennedy had been president for 8 months, making it only 5 months since the Bay of Pigs fiasco. That same month, Russian cosmonaut Yuri Gagarin became the first person in space, prompting President Kennedy to call for a national initiative to put a man on the moon by the end of the decade.
For the eyes of the world, now look into space, to the moon, and to the planets beyond.
During that same September, Betty and Barney Hill took a vacation. The couple lived in Portsmouth, a small city on New Hampshire's Atlantic coast. They drove west across Massachusetts and New York State to see Niagara Falls. From there, they crossed into Canada and visited Toronto. They were planning to drive east and spend a final night in Montreal before returning home, but that plan changed. Barney Hill was African-American. He worked a graveyard shift as a distribution clerk in the South Boston Postal Annex. Every day he made a grueling 2-hour commute from their home in Portsmouth to the north. His wife, Betty Hill, was white. She was a social worker for the state of New Hampshire. Both were active in the community, particularly on the issue of civil rights. Barney was an officer in the Portsmouth NAACP, a member of the New Hampshire State Advisory Board of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, and a member of the board of directors of the Rockingham County Poverty Program. Betty was involved in the NAACP as well and was the United Nations envoy to the Unitarian Universalist Church of Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Their civil rights work even earned them an invitation to Lyndon Johnson's presidential inauguration. In short, they were professionals and respected members of their community. On the night of September 19th, instead of spending the night in Montreal as initially planned, Betty and Barney decided to drive home. Why did they change their minds? Depends on who you ask. It could be that they got lost in Montreal and were unsettled because they couldn't understand directions given in French. Or that they wanted to get home before Tropical Storm Esther arrived in New England. Or maybe they simply ran out of money. Regardless, they cut their vacation short and headed home. Betty and Barney re-entered the United States at a remote border crossing near the town of Colebrook, New Hampshire. It was there they stopped to eat before making their way back on the road. 2 years later, Betty and Barney would undergo hypnosis to try to recall the strange events of this night.
You will remember everything, and you will tell me everything.
Yes.
These sessions were recorded and transcripts made, so we have a detailed account of Betty and Barney's stop in Colebrook. The recordings, with a couple of exceptions, continue to be in private hands, but the transcripts are available. In a couple of places, we will use actual audio from Betty and Barney's separate hypnosis sessions. In other places, actors will read from transcripts. In one of these sessions that took place on February 22, 1964, Barney recalled this visit to the restaurant, performed here by an actor.
There is a dark-skinned woman in there. I think dark by Caucasian standards, and I wonder, is she a light-skinned Negro, or is she Indian, or is she white? She waits on us, and she is not very friendly, and I notice this. And others are there, and they're looking at me and at Betty, and they seem to be friendly or pleased, but this dark-skinned woman doesn't. I wonder them more so. Is she Negro? And wonder if I know she is Negro and is passing for white. I eat a hamburger, and I become impatient with Betty to drink her coffee so we can get started. And the clock on my watch says 5 minutes after 10, and I know I should be in Portsmouth, I think by 2 o'clock.
They left Colebrook, heading south on a dark, remote highway. They were about 60 miles south of the Canadian border when it happened. While Barney was driving, Betty caught something out the window.
When they were about 4 miles south of Lancaster, New Hampshire, Betty spotted a new light in the sky.
Kathleen Martin is the director of Experiencer Research for the Mutual UFO Network, or MUFON.
I am also the niece of Betty and Barney Hill. I was 13 years old when they had their experience in the White Mountains of New Hampshire. At first, she thought of a falling star, but she realized that falling stars don't fall upwards, and that's what this one was doing. She thought, well, could it possibly be a satellite? But that didn't make sense either. My family was interested in the space program, and my grandfather, brother, and I used to go out and look for satellites at night. They continued to drive south on Route 3 through upstate New Hampshire, and she was watching this light in the sky as it grew larger and larger. It was a bright, light night, so it was easy to see outside. The moon was about 3/4 full. As she watched this and it grew larger and larger, she became very curious. So south of Twin Mountain, she asked Barney to stop by the side of the road. This was at the Mount Cleveland picnic area. And they got out of the car with binoculars and looked up at this thing in the sky. The perplexing thing is that it did not make any sound whatsoever. Barney was arguing that it must be a commercial plane and they simply couldn't hear it, en route to perhaps Montreal or Toronto. And then this object bounced back in the sky toward Barney. He realized it was highly unusual. He was still attempting to identify it. Betty had already returned to the car. He got in and said, oh, it's really nothing. It's just a plane.
They entered Franconia Notch State Park, where steep mountains rise on each side of the road, and there are no houses to be seen. This stretch is one of the most beautiful in New Hampshire and isolated. It can also be claustrophobic, especially at night.
So they proceeded south into Franconia Notch, and as they passed by Cannon Mountain, they got a view of this object passing over the top of a building on top of the mountain, and the light in the building blinked out as it passed by.
Strange arrivals will return in a moment. As they entered Franconia Notch, Betty and Barney watched as the light that they'd been tracking flew over Cannon Mountain. In a hypnosis transcript, read here by an actress, Betty described losing track of the object.
I don't know if it went down in the valley between the two mountains or if it turned its light off. And this puzzled me because I kept looking for it. And then I thought, well, maybe they're going away. They aren't interested in us. But then we came out by Old Man of the Mountains, and there it was.
The Old Man of the Mountain was a rock formation in Franconia Notch that looked like the profile of a craggy face. From the time they left Mount Cleveland Picnic Area, they perceived that the light was following them. The couple made several brief stops to get a look at it, but it was their stop by the Old Man in the Mountain that caused a change in their experience. What had been a point of light in the sky was now a craft of some sort, a physical object with a shape and a size and colored lights, and it made no sound.
They stopped again at the base of the Old Man of the Mountain. They got out and they looked up at this thing again through binoculars. The old man's profile, I believe, is 48 feet from forehead to chin. And they then were able to measure the diameter of this object. They said that it was about 1.5 times, maybe a little more, the length of the old man's profile.
That's about 75 feet, or 6 cars lined up back to back.
As they're watching it, it appeared to be lighted on only one side, and it appeared to be rotating, which was very perplexing. And then it started to move in a stair-step pattern, this very unusual pattern. Barney, of course, was in a hurry. He wanted to get home. He was wide awake. He'd been well-rested the night before, but they knew that they could stop for some rest if they grew tired.
This point about Barney being well-rested would become a matter of dispute later on.
So they got into the car, they drove south, and as they exited Franconia Notch and came into North Lincoln, that object swooped down in the sky. And then they realized that it was a highly unusual craft. Barney stopped the car in the center of the highway because the object was overhead. And the object at first appeared to be about 200 feet high, and then it appeared to descend to about 100 feet above their vehicle.
We saw the object off in a great distance. It appeared to be winking, but now that it was close, it looked as if there was just one solid band of light, and this was moving backwards.
This is Barney, interviewed by Harv Morgan for the Cleveland-based radio show Contact on October 5th, 1964, 3 years after the fact.
And I had slowed the car down to approximately 5 miles an hour. Well, this was very upsetting, so I came to a complete stop in the center of the highway. I got out of the car, and I took the binoculars. I rest my left arm on the door that was open to the car door and my right elbow on the roof of the car, and I tried to look, but the car was... motor was running, so I had to step away. As I stepped away from the car, the object swung from the passenger side over to the left, which would have been the side that I was driving, making a large arc-like turn, placing it over a field.
Barney was transfixed by the ship. He walked away from the car and into the field to a point where he was just below the craft.
There was absolutely no sound associated with this object. It must have at the time been approximately 100 feet up or above my head. This would be about 10 stories up. The size of it was about approximately, if you were looking at a large
military plane or at any commercial airliner from tail to head. This is the size of it as the series of windows were around it. This is how huge it was.
He trained his binoculars on those windows and saw about 10 figures looking back at him.
There was nothing unusual about them. They did have on what I thought was a black-type shiny uniform, similar to the black leather-type jacket you find motorcyclists wearing. The one that I will now, for identifying purposes, call a leader, well, he had on a military-type cap with the visor, while the others did not. They moved back away from the window while this one with the black leather-type uniform, I will say uniform, continued to look down at me.
Well, I think you indicated earlier that they were pretty human-looking.
Yes, and you have to consider that looking at anyone in a window 10 stories up with a binocular, the only thing you can discern is that they look human and nothing grotesque about them.
Mm-hmm. Hill, this is Wes Fitch. Did you feel there was anything sinister about these people? Did you get that impression?
Yes, I did. Only that it was a strange situation, and therefore I have thought of this many times. That is to say, was there anything sinister about them, or was it because of the unusual situation that I was in, magnifying my feelings? I did feel that there was something sinister, strange, unusual about the whole thing.
One of the beings remained at the window, looking at Barney, who looked back through his binoculars. The others turned away and, from what Barney could see, began to pull levers that were attached to a panel in the wall. This lever pulling seemed to deploy what Barney described as fan-type wings, tipped by red lights.
Well, this was too much for me, and I made a hasty retreat to the car, screaming to the wife that they had seen me, they had seen us, and we had to get away.
Barney sounds very calm in this interview, but Barney's hypnosis session on February 22, 1964, gives a sense of the trauma of this moment. A warning, this clip is very emotionally intense.
This creature, this leader, is telling me something.
He's telling you something. How? How is he getting it to you?
I can see it in his face.
Do you see his lips move? Yes.
No, his lips aren't moving.
Yes, go on. He's telling you.
He's looking at me.
What did he tell you?
Stay there and keep looking. Just keep looking and stay there. And just keep looking. Just keep looking.
Could you hear him tell you?
Oh, I gotta pull these binoculars away from my eyes. Because if I don't, I'll just keep staying there.
Could you hear him tell you this?
Oh, no, he didn't say it.
You felt he said it.
I know.
You know he
said it. Just there, yeah. Just stay there, he's saying to me. It's
all right.
Pounding in my head.
All right.
Pull the binoculars away. God, give me strength.
All right.
Pull them down. Run. Pull these binoculars down and run. God, if there's a God, give me strength. I gotta get away. Oh. Benny.
All right.
Gotta get away, Benny.
All right. Calm down.
I'm trying.
I gotta
get away.
Barney fled back to the car in a panic. He was convinced that the figures on the craft had seen him and were going to capture him and Betty. They started driving south again, trying to get away. And then they heard a series of beeps coming, it seemed, from the rear of their car.
These beeps were very peculiar because it was much like a tuning fork being struck and placed against you, a very subtle type vibration. And that's the way the car vibrated. And it was beep, 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 beep. And I said to my wife, my God, what is that? I said, look out the window. They're right overhead. And she looked out of the window, but you couldn't see anything. And later we find out that you couldn't see the sky as well. So apparently the craft had moved overhead over us.
This beeping noise was followed by a hazy period for both Betty and Barney, almost as if they dozed off. For 30 miles of driving, they didn't speak with each other. They had only vague memories of this period, including the impression that they'd seen something glowing, maybe the moon.
And then 35 miles further south, we were beeped again, and this is the only time my wife and I then began to communicate with one another by saying, well, what was it we saw? This is surprising because that 35-mile period, we did not discuss anything.
They were unsettled, but they continued towards home. They took a detour into Concord, the state capital, trying to find a cup of coffee and a police officer to tell their story to. At that time of the morning, they found neither.
They just drove on to their home in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, expecting to arrive about 2 o'clock in the morning. But when they arrived, it was already dawn, sun was streaking the sky. It was closer to 5 o'clock.
There's a 2 or 3 hour gap between when Betty and Barney expected to arrive in Portsmouth and when they actually did. This quote-unquote missing time becomes a key piece of evidence in support of the Hill's story. Betty and Barney Hill arrived at their home at about 5 in the morning on September 20th. They had driven through the night from Montreal. They had memories of a harrowing experience with a UFO and were exhausted and distressed. Betty was afraid that the things that they had in their car might be contaminated. She wouldn't let Barney bring the bags inside the house. They threw away the food they had in their cooler. And then they began to notice strange things. Things that seemed like evidence.
Barney went into the house and checked the time. His watch had stopped running at that point, so he just reset it and rewound it. The same thing happened to Betty. Her watch was not running either, even though she had set it at 10 o'clock that evening. Both watches broke on the same night within a certain time frame. Those watches never ran again.
Looking for advice, particularly about possible contamination, Betty called her sister, who had a neighbor that was a physicist.
The neighbor, for some reason, told Betty that if she had a compass, she should take it to the car to see how the needle on the compass would react.
In 1999, folklorist John Horgan interviewed Betty Hill in her home. It was one of the last interviews she gave.
What happens when you look at the car?
Highly polished spots on the trunk of the car. And that day, we were getting tropical rains from a hurricane that was going through. And it was heavy downpour and didn't affect spots at all. They stayed there for months.
Your sister, who claimed to have seen a UFO, suggested that you do what around the car?
She talked to a physicist. Mm-hmm. Who said go out with a compass and check out the spots, which we did.
What happened?
And the compass was very, very erratic.
Almost spinning or just...
Yeah, it was, you know. And we tried it on different other parts of the car and it didn't react that
But just near where the spots were.
Just the spots.
Hence the inference being a magnetic anomaly. Yeah. Something was really distorting the magnetic draw of the compass. Yeah.
She remembered the strange buzzing noises coming from the rear of the car from the night before. She wondered if these spots might be connected to that sound. And there were more strange clues.
Betty's best dress that she had been wearing that day was torn in several places. It was torn at the top of the zipper, a 1-inch tear on one side, a 2-inch tear on the other. It was torn from waist to hemline. The hem was torn down on one side. She couldn't understand how this happened as she was sitting as a passenger in the seat of this vehicle. The binocular strap on the binoculars that Barney had around his neck was severed. He couldn't understand why there was vegetative matter on his clothing. Also, Barney's best dress shoes were so deeply scraped that he had to buy new shoes. He was a meticulous dresser, so he used them for yard work after that. He couldn't understand that either. But there was no conscious recall for a couple of hours of their time even when they considered the moments that they stopped to look at this craft, it was very, very perplexing.
The stopped watches, Barney's scuffed shoes, the spots on the trunk, and then Betty's torn dress, the broken binocular strap, the missing time. All these bits of evidence confirmed to the Hills that what they had experienced that night was abnormal. But it also seemed that there was something missing, something forgotten. 2 years later, when they would undergo hypnosis and new memories would emerge, they would find that there was more to the story. Next time on Strange Arrivals.
Strange Arrivals is a production of iHeartRadio and Grim and Mild from Aaron Mankey. This episode was written and hosted by Toby Ball and produced by Miranda Hawkins and Josh Thane, with executive producers Alex Williams, Matt Frederick, and Aaron Mankey. Betty Hill was portrayed by Gina Rakicki.
Barney Hill was portrayed by Jason Williams.
Special thanks to the Milne Special Collections and Archives at the University of New Hampshire, John Horrigan, WICH 1310 AM in Norwich, Connecticut, John White and David O'Leary, the executive producer of the History Channel's dramatic series, Project Blue Book. Learn more about the show over at grimandmild.com. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.